All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Here's to Your Health with Dr. Burns. I am Dr. Burns. Today we have Aaliyah Marr with us. How are you doing, Aaliyah?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. So the reason why, you know, Aaliyah here, you are, seem to be one busy lady with everything that you do, from creative coaching to writing to blogging to I don't know what else. And so I thought it was intriguing that you have this thing where you said that there's more creative minds like in this day and age than like any other time. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain that and why you feel that this is like the time now that there's more creativeness energy in the air.
Well, what it is that what I said is actually there's more creative geniuses on this planet, which is upping the ante on your statement there. I believe that, if you go back to, like, you know, like the, what was it, the 15th century, the Renaissance, when, you know, there was like one creative genius or two. You had Da Vinci and you had Leonardo, and you had Leonardo da Vinci and you had Michelangelo, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you had other people as well, but that's what we know now. And, of course, women were completely cut out of this. You know, women had no part at all in it because we were busy raising children.
Yes.
And so what would happen is that you had only the chance, that because everything was pretty repressive, you had only the chance for a few people to get to open their minds, to not just get educated, but and if you go back in history, you could say, well, before the Renaissance, the only people that were educated were the clergy. And those people only educated so far as they could copy things, you know. So there was no originality that was at all encouraged. And you can say that also about, you know, a lot of Eastern stuff as well. So, you know, only the people at the very top had any chance, any luxury, you know, any time to think as an individual, or to be an individual.
Okay.
So,
go ahead.
So this has been coming on for a while, but it also has to do with a consciousness shift. And that's what's really intriguing to me, because the consciousness is what I call it quantum, you know, quantum consciousness. If you think about it, consciousness is not something you can measure. It's not something you can weigh. It doesn't have material substance. Therefore, it's at the quantum level. It's at the subatomic level, which means it operates according to completely different rules. And this is where the right brain exists. The right brain is the creative brain. It's the untapped potential in every person. And that untapped potential has been sort of relegated to the background at this point because so much left brain activity is emphasized. You know, we're taught to, you know, stick to a schedule. You know, we're taught to, you know, have goals. This is all left brain stuff. We're taught to memorize data, which doesn't free you. Data doesn't free you at all. And the only people that have really had any chance to exit this very kind of restrictive environment that we've all been brought up in, even, you know, even today, the only people that really had a chance historically have been the artists. And so that this whole world is going to be saved by people that are coming from a less repressive upbringing or experience, and a more open-minded experience, which is the whole open focus, Les Feni's idea of the open focus brain, which is a different kind of thinking, or a more right brain kind of thinking. So that's where I'm coming from with this, is that once you start to open people up, which is happening through the internet, through, you know, all these different, you know, instead of having broadcast media, which, you know, wrote a book on social media that's not broadcast media anymore, it's collaborative media. Once you have collaborative media, such as viral videos that anyone can post up there now, you start to have this acceleration of consciousness. And it's getting so fast that I'll give you an example of what's happening now, which is really crazy to me. Whenever I write a new book, the phrase comes into my head, and I know what the title is going to be, and the whole book is based on the title. Well, I did this kind of backwards because I'm redesigning a tarot deck. And that tarot deck I did years ago, someone else has a title, I have to retitle it. So I go online, and I check to see all these titles that I find. And a year ago, I could find unique titles. Now it's very, very, very hard.
Hmm.
So that means that, you know, like, for instance, Darwin, you know, Charles Darwin, I can't remember who it was that came up with the same theory of evolution. That was just a theory still. You know, the same theory of evolution at the same time as Darwin, and they weren't in communication with each other. They were at different ends of the world, because Darwin was sailing around on a beagle, you know, and this other, by the way, there's a great movie about Darwin called Creation, wonderful mm-hmm. movie. But they couldn't communicate, and so they came up with it at the same time. Why? Because the mind is quantum. Consciousness is quantum. And our brains are kind of like radio receivers and transmitters. And we're transmitting and receiving consciousness all the time. And as this consciousness starts to flow more easily, you know, via technology, via the communication that seems to be more democratic than it ever was, right? It's never been democratic until the modern day. It was always controlled. And it still is. So a lot of people watch TV and read, you know, newspapers and things like that. It's still very controlled. And they don't know this. But once people start becoming participants in this communication, in a true dialogue, then this goes in. It accelerates, and it's accelerating every day. And so these people are just waking up to their real, everyone is a creative genius. But there are more people that have woken up to it today than ever before.
Okay. Well, now, with all this that you have with the creative genius and with going back to like the Renaissance and with the energies, what exactly got you involved in all of this in the first place? What was the thing for you that said, aha, this is it. This is, this is my passion and this is what I'm going to focus on. What was that like for you when, or through that journey that made you decide to actually dive into this?
Well, to sort of sum it up, when I was a kid, I graduated I didn't actually graduate from high school, which bothered my mother tremendously in later years. But what I did is I went a year early into college, and I took up art. And then I decided after about a year in college to really just apply for the best art school I could find. Right, and so I found this art school in France called Les Beaux-Arts. It's actually the National School of Fine Arts. And it's also where a lot of these famous artists went to. And in the United States, art is not appreciated. It's real art. I mean, culture is it's like there's no culture here except maybe car culture or football culture or something like that. But if you go to Europe, it's a completely different consciousness of the past and of the culture and the sense of that culture and the meaning of that culture. It really is life-changing. I think everyone should go be educated in another country at a very impressionable age the way I was. So I went over when I was 19. And I told my mother, I said, you've got to let me go because I got accepted at that school. You've got to let me go because it's the only thing I can do. She wanted me to be in commercial art, which incidentally I went into later on. It was, you know, called commercial art at the time. That was called design, graphic design. But she wanted me to do that just to try to make a living. And I don't blame her. If I were a parent, I'd be pretty scared too. But the thing was, as I said, that was the only thing I could do. And later on, I found out that because I studied art, my mind opened up in ways that it could not have in any other field. Because I was studying something that had no applicability and wasn't even valued by the culture I was born in. It freed me to develop myself. To me, art is a self-development technique, and it develops your consciousness and your connection and your ability to get all this stuff from the, you know, quantum soup of consciousness that's out there. It's all out there. All you have to do is tune in, like you're the radio. You're tuning in your brain to that right stream of consciousness. And then once you tune in, it's amazing what you can get. And I realized after I'd been, you know, after I had come back, and this is some years later, that there wasn't anything I couldn't do because I had this amazing background in art, in this thing that was so impractical in so many people's minds, but extremely practical, taught me so many things about communication, about thinking, and the kind of thinking that's not valued, but hasn't been valued, but will be valued, will be incredibly valued, will be, it's the gold, it's the platinum of, it's the diamond in the rough, and it's within every single person on this planet, but they're already creating their reality. They're already creating things in the world. You know, their disease, their health, their, you know, we've heard this all about the law of attraction, but it really is a discipline of the mind. And once you realize you're conscious, you can't go back.
Okay. Now, what does that? I mean, and it's true. I mean, it's like once I guess, like you say, that people get out of their like quote box, you know, or outside their belief window. Sometimes people get scared and they go back in. When you're trying to counsel people or coach them through, like this new consciousness, one is that do you actually? Do people tell you what it is that this new feeling is for them? And if so, or do they ever do that? And then what are some steps that you usually get people to be comfortable, you know, like to like expand, you know, outside of their normal realm?
Well, there is some discipline involved, without a doubt. I've had personally to go through an enormous amount of personal self-discipline of constantly dumping beliefs. And lately, it's been dumping emotions, and I no longer want. I mean, I literally eradicated nostalgia some years ago, and most recently, I eradicated envy. Now, it comes back every now and then, but it's no longer merely what it was, and it's no longer a force in my life because it can't come back without me being conscious of it. So there is some work involved, but what I encourage people to do, because they don't understand that they. By the time, and this is in my first book, Parallel Mind, The Art of Creativity. When I wrote that book, chapter 2 is about the duality that we have within us. You know, this whole world is a duality-based world. That's what causes the polarity. I was just thinking the other day, the reason why a battery or a magnet works is because of polarity. Because of this perfect polarity. That's the reason why this world works the way it does. So we rely upon duality. A lot of us have had, you know, studying anything esoteric and said, well, duality is bad. No. I think we should enjoy being here. And so this whole earth is like a playground for somebody who's creatively empowered. And this duality that we experience in ourselves has to do with the you know, when you're a child, you have parents. And the parents tell you, they give you limits on your behavior because they don't want you to get killed, you know, run out in the street, get killed, or whatever. But sometimes they do more than put limits on your behavior. They put their own limits on your behaviors, meaning that they, instead of putting a limit that keeps you safe, they put a limit that tells you that you can't do something, that, you know, it's not possible for you to do something. And so that is injurious to the child. But the child learns this because none of us grew up with completely functional parents, you know. There comes a point where one has to really
not so much forgive one's parents, but understand them and understand that they did the best they could within the limitations that they had set up for themselves or whatever. So, but when you grow up, what happens is that even if your parents are still alive, they're a voice in your head. And they become your, in that, it becomes your guard. So in other words, the guardian, your parents, the voice in your head becomes the guard. Instead of being guardian, the guard. And the child in you, through rebellion, which we all rebel against irrationality, you know, rebel against things that go against our inner child, that beautiful, clear, creative self that's inside of us. That's the creativity. It's right there. It's in the inner child, that pure being that knows nothing, knows no limitations. It's never been told that they're wrong, they're less than perfect. And when you have never been told that, you never, ever have this duality set up inside of you. But all of us on this earth, practically all of us, I don't know anyone who's had an ideal childhood, but we all end up having this duality inside of us, which is the parent and the child. Now, the parent can be the guardian or the guard, and the child can be childlike or childish. If you're in rebellion, you're childish. If you're your natural self, you're childlike. So we have that duality, and that's what's keeping us. And from that, accessing that whole incredibly strong, powerful self that's inside, that's so gentle and sweet and vulnerable and new and fresh to the world. And what an artist does, what a real artist does, the real goal of an artist is to be completely fresh to the world every single moment of the day. And that discipline of being completely fresh to the world is what teaches us to go back to the inner child. That's where it is.
So then with the artist, I mean, because there are some people with, you know, the artist mentality, that is that they don't worry about anything, and they're just like, well, if it happens, it happens. So is that kind of what you're personifying here? Is that, or are you talking more, or is there more to it than just kind of from that area? Because it's like, because I know the artist brain is so different than anything else, and sometimes it can just sometimes artists frustrate me because they're just so, either like so laid back, or there's just something different from the way that they think.
Yes, that's true. But be aware of the fact that the artist simply has linked into a huge part of the brain that most of us are closed out of. That's all. Now, how much self-discipline they have is another thing entirely, because the self-discipline comes from another area. It doesn't come from the artist's brain. You know, for simplification, remember, this is very simplified. The right brain is the creative brain. Mm-hmm. The right brain is where all inspiration comes from, in my opinion. And I'm talking about pure creativity. In my book, I delineate between pure and applied creativity. Pure creativity is what an artist does when they're not working for any goal, they're not thinking about making money off any, there's no practical use to their work other than their own personal pleasure and personal development, which I think art really is. Applied creativity, everything else we think of is creativity, everything else, you know, including writing a book. That's applied creativity. Taking something from the right brain and translating it to the left brain in a way that will communicate to my audience. Now, yes, there are the flighty artists, and I'm not putting them up on a pedestal. And they drive me crazy too. So I'm just saying, accessing the right brain, it can be like a Pandora's box. You know, people get stuck at certain levels, too, as artists, you know. I'm just saying that accessing the right brain is what will bring us back to the incredible levels of empowerment and joy. How you interface with your left brain when you're able to access the right brain, determines your ability basically to communicate what you experience. Have you ever had an experience, and a lot of mystics have had this, that, you know, I think most people have had an experience that you just couldn't describe to someone else? Have you ever had anything like that?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. And when you tried to describe it, which you probably did, because you're like, you're so awed out, you're like, oh my goodness, you know, what it was, you know, like, you know, you're so awed out, you got to go and tell your best friend, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't you feel like that was so, like, the words to, like, never describe this, and that you, like, almost trivialized it by even trying to put it in words?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then all of a sudden, then the person's kind of looking at me a little weird. They're just like, sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know. And imagine if you could have those experiences all the time. Imagine if that is the way we're really supposed to be. It's indescribable state. Now, as an artist, I'm a communicator. It's my job to communicate my experience as best that I can, which is sometimes I use poetry to do that. I found that one of the things I learned being an artist is that once I became one kind of artist, I could apply that to becoming any other kind of artist. So I became a poet. I became a multimedia artist. I programmed games. I've done all kinds of art forms. I've done improvisational comedy. Every form of art form there is becomes accessible to you because it's just a different way of expressing something. And when you have multiple art forms to choose from, you choose them for different expressions. So, for instance, when I paint, that is for visually describing the ineffable, the things that I cannot, I can't put them in words. I can't even say that I have this knowledge, but it comes through me in a painting, right? And so these paintings become incredible because they don't know where they come from. And they're like, all of a sudden, you're like, okay, I need to paint this, but I don't know why. I don't try to ask myself why I'm painting that or why it needs to be there. I put it there, and when it looks right, I'm like, oh, yep, that was right. I don't know why. I don't even know what this thing's about, right? So it's actually a form of conceptual, well, I don't know, it's not really conceptual, but the form of expression that I can't do in any other way, in no other medium. Now, when I have high emotions that need to, that are churning around or not, or amazing emotions, I use poetry. So I'll have, like, you know, a time when I write a lot of poetry. And the amazing thing about that is kind of like blues music. Poetry, I think, is kind of like blues music. And my friend Peter, if he's listening to this, will, you know, I can hear him cringing because he hates blues. But for me, blues music is cathartic. It takes, you know, sad lyrics and you know, funny music, and it makes me happy to listen to it, even though the content is sad. So it's very cathartic. And I think that poetry is the same thing. I can take terrible emotions, terrible thoughts, you know, and I put it in beautiful language, and it takes it, and it makes it into beauty. It takes something awful and makes it beautiful. So it's sublime, the way that Joseph Campbell talks about that art isn't beautiful. It's sublime. Even when it's ugly, it can be sublime. Because it takes you, it transforms you in the experience of the work. It by the fact, the mere fact that we're humans communicating, and you can identify with this emotion. You've ever seen, heard a song. And you could be kind of happy one minute, and you hear this song, and it suddenly plunges you into sadness. Or the other way around, you're sad, and you hear this song, and it uplifts you. that where is it in the song? Sometimes even only music does that. But there's no lyrics. It's magical. So emotion, to me, hits me on an emotion. Music hits me on an emotional level. So
now,
this all art is that way. It doesn't always hit on the same level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, well, now, when you have someone that you're trying to coach and you're trying mm-hmm. to get them to open up, at first, are these people kind of like guarded and hesitant and not really sure with it? And then how long do you think it takes them to start to relax and actually start becoming like a little bit more comfortable with being vulnerable and opening themselves up?
It can happen instantaneously. In fact, I think, you know, my work could be reduced in a few minutes, to tell you the truth. And that's more so now than ever, because I can see how a person who's creatively empowered can activate people. I've been literally thinking about, you know, taking groups of people and just saying, okay, I'll turn you on and turn you on. Flip the switch. I call it flipping the switch. We're going to flip the switch. See, there's a toggle switch inside of people. You know, it's invisible. Most people can't see it, but I can see it. And there's, and that toggle switch simply needs to be flipped to the on position. It's in the off position. It's like you've got this amazing device. Like this amazing multi-purpose device that can change your life, and it's sitting inside of you, and it just hasn't been discovered or turned on yet. And all that needs to happen is you need to be in the proximity, or within my voice, range of my voice, and I can just go, whoop, and you're on. And you'll get it. I mean, it's very easy to get. Now, there are other people that, you know, like, they're like, oh, they argue for their limitations, or they have more blocks, and they need more time. And that's totally fine, you know. I'll tell you an example. One client who since then has become a coach herself. And she was trying to do this, she was trying to put her business on the web and never having done it before. And so she was overwhelmed with all this technology, and she had, you know, she was very concerned about stuff. And I was originally talking to her to do some writing for her. And about three times in the conversation, I heard her keep on saying, I need help. And so I stopped the whole thing and I said, you don't need a copywriter. You need a coach. And she said, yeah. I said, okay. I'm going to give you an assignment. Now, she happened to be also a poet, and quite a good one. And I didn't know that at the time. I said, well, I'm going to give you an assignment. And I think at the first assignment I told her to do, okay, I'll tell you one of the assignments. I said, what's on your coffee table? And she said, well, and she's a smoker, a cigarette and a coffee cup. I said, well, you write a poem about the cigarette and the coffee cup. So it seemed like fun to her. She wrote the most amazing poem about how the cigarette and the coffee cup were having a love affair.
Oh, my gosh.
They fell into the couch instead of the flame. And I was like, that is absolutely brilliant. But I told her, her first assignment was to go out and play. I said, you haven't been out playing. I'm going to give you permission to play. You cannot do any work this weekend. None. You're not allowed to touch it. Take a camera and shoot photos. Go to thrift stores. Go someplace where you can explore and see things. Not cultured, sophisticated things, but junk. Look at junk. Look at things you normally wouldn't look at. You know, I used to tell my design students when I was working in New York City, and, you know, when you work in New York City, you have to take the subway, unless, of course, you're very wealthy, you take a cab everywhere you go or something. But you're doing a lot of walking, and you're in the subways, and the subways are not the cleanest places, and there's a lot of bums in there and stuff like that. And I said to my students, I said, the day that you can see urine stain on the subway floor and be excited by it without a reference to where it came from or what it is, then you're an artist. And that was very similar to what Leonardo da Vinci said, I think, to his students. He used to find stains on his walls, and he would see things in them. The artist sees things. They see. Everybody else is just looks, but the artist sees. And that seeing, that ability to notice, that ability to be in the moment and to be just totally absorbed, obsessed, whatever, with whatever you're looking at, is so amazing. It's an experience like nothing else. And that's where you access that inner child. Because what you were like when you were a child is just like that. You had no preconceptions, no judgment, no little judge sitting on your shoulder saying, that line you drew, that wasn't perfect right there. You had no judge like that. And so the playing aspect is very important. I tell them all to play. You know, what's fun for you? And I'm not talking about entertainment. Passive entertainment. We're talking about active entertainment. Because all it is play. The best things are always discovered, not because of a purpose, that's applied creativity. Not because of a goal. Not because they made money. Because somebody was playing around. The whole history of lithography. Was a guy, was an artist. A lot of things are discovered by artists. There's this artist who wrote his laundry list with a grease crayon on a stone. That's how lithography was discovered, which is printing method, you know, today, you know, before they discovered Xerox machines and all of that. So it's just playing. It's just so simple. And that's the other thing about the childlike simplicity of being an artist, is rediscovering the simplicity. If you try to make something, if you go at things from the complexity, you will never get anywhere. You only create more complexity. But if you go from the simple to the complex, that's the genius of being an artist. The complex is just the details of the simple. You know, so you start with the simple and go to the complex. Like that famous phrase, was it Beethoven? Dun, 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 dun.
Mm-hmm.
Dun, 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 dun. What is that? It's extremely simple.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the art. You can spend a lifetime trying to get to that, just the way Picasso did. The best Picasso paintings aren't his early work. It's when he started to really get childlike.
Mm-hmm.
So with the simplicity that everyone needs to basically reconnect to, do you feel that with as engaged as we are with electronics via TV, video games, you know, internet, computers, cell phones, do you think that stagnates people's genius and not being able to tap into it?
Yeah. Yes, some of it does. Some of it enables us, just as, you know, like I discussed earlier with the, you know, the speeding up of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you a little story. I was a very young bookaholic. My mother taught me to read. And before I entered school, and I literally used to go to the library, my bike. I had 10 years on the bike back, and I would just bring home dozens of books, and I felt wealthy. books were wealth. And I used to sit in trees and read my books, and by the time I was like 14, I was reading 3 books a day. I was literally skimming these books. And I was getting bored, you know. So I told myself, and I was 14, I said, you got to stop reading. Really a bad habit. You can't watch TV either. You know, the rest of my family is in there watching TV. And So I would shut myself in that room, and I said, you have to create something. You have to do something. And that's where I started that day when I made that decision. It was hard, you know? Mm-hmm. But you have to go from passive to active. Very important. Just being a passive consumer is not where it's at. And because that's basically a type of slave mentality, just simply consume and consume and consume, you know? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a slave mentality. But it's also someone who's incredibly bored because, you know, your consumption, the only thing you can do is make it higher. You can't make it better. You know, you can only make it higher. You can only eat more. You can get better, you know, furniture like that. But, you know, it's only good when you don't own it. When you own it, it's accepted, you know, taken for granted. And then you have a responsibility for that ownership that, you know, you have to dispose of it and drag it around with you everywhere you go. You know, whenever you move, you have to drag around the furniture you bought. And, you know, so where's the freedom in that?
Yeah.
And to me, it's mind freedom. It really is the most insidious form of slavery is mind slavery. And that's what happens through entertainment. And you know, people that are... only entertain themselves. You know, they're taking in they're taking in sort of pre-digested stuff that people want them to think a certain way by consuming this material. Now that's a little radical, perhaps. But what happened a few years ago, and it happened before I wrote my first book. I'd gotten back into reading. I couldn't read anything anymore. Nothing. And I was reading historical novels at the time before this happened. And this sudden, you know, complete inability to read anyone else's story. Now, a few years later than that, after I wrote my book, I recognized I couldn't watch TV anymore. I couldn't watch a movie anymore because I didn't want anyone else's story. All these stories would be in my mind. If I watched the movie, I'd be thinking about it the next day. I'd be, you know, creating this story in my head about my own life, even. And I wanted to exit the story. I wanted to be fresh and not going over history. I wanted to be present, is basically. You can only be present if you're not living in someone else's story or in your own story, your own old story, you know, your own old history. How many of us have tried to become a new person? And yet we still hold on to nostalgia. We still hold on to the past. We still hold on to, someone else's story, you know, someone else, the movie, the multi-million dollar movie. Somebody's going to be, you know, they're creating a message for you. They're creating a timeline for you. And you're living in that when you're watching it. And if it doesn't uplift you, then what are you doing? You know, there's a lot of people watching these things, and it's bringing them down. It's bringing them into this idea that the world is inherently violent. Well, that's only true if you agree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or that, you know, a bug is going to come and get you, you know, you're going to get a disease, you're going to get cancer. Well, because why? Because my mother had cancer, my father had cancer, and therefore I must get cancer. No, that's not true unless you agree it is. And when you agree it is, you've added your personal power to someone else's idea. That's what politicians do. They're all waiting for us to add our little spark of personal power, a little bit that we have, to their power. And that's how they get in power. But if we didn't do that, if we said, wait a minute, I don't believe in this hierarchical system. I don't believe that anyone's superior to me. We're all equal. And at that, that's a truly revolutionary idea. We believe in true equality. Meaning that, you know, I don't believe that I'm superior to anyone else, nor is anyone else superior to me. That's true equality. And yet we don't live in a world that promotes that.
So do you also believe that with the equality too, is it people who think themselves lower then other people should, because also consider that's also considered an inequality as well. So the better than, also the less than as well.
Absolutely. That's where it comes from. The idea that you could be lesser than anything else, anyone else on this planet or whatever, is where the slavery thing comes from. Because they're preying upon what I call a kernel of an idea. That kernel is a base concept. Like the theory of evolution, here's a good one. Here's a good kernel. Somehow it's communicated, even though that's Darwin's idea at all, that the survival of the fittest is the basis for evolution. That, that there's competition for limited resources. So evolution is based upon this competition, and that's why, animals evolve on this earth, or plants and animals and everything like that evolved on this earth because of competition, because of survival-based planet. That is a survival-based planet. Now, there's another theory of evolution that's not popular. And I guess it's not popular because it's not advantageous to the powers that were, I don't call them powers that be, but powers that were, to promote this idea of synergy and cooperation. But that is the other theory. And if you look at your body is made up of cells. We're not single-celled organisms. So at the point where the single-cell organism decided to partner with another cell, divide and partner with another cell, at that point, they had to take on, at some point in this evolution, not necessarily when they're just two cells, but at some point, they had to take on specialized functions in order to exist in the same body. So your liver doesn't do the same thing as your heart does. There's certain cells that each cell is, all these groups of cells have decided to work in cooperation and synergy. No being on this planet that has a mother could exist without the mother's care. No society can live without their mother. In human society. Mm-hmm. Well, it's true in the animal world as well. There's very few animals that just simply give birth and don't even take care of the babies. I would say turtles. Turtles are like that. I've seen turtles hatch out of eggs and the mother's nowhere around, right? The mother provided for the turtles, making sure they were deep enough, the eggs were deep enough in the nest and stuff like that. Chose a good night to go up on shore. But there's no other protection. Now, most animals, though, do protect the young. So there is a cooperation, the need for cooperation. And human society being the flower, should we say, of this consciousness on Earth, there's a need for extreme cooperation among humanity. And what we notice instead is this divide and conquer thing, which keeps certain people at the top of this concept of hierarchy. But if we take away the concept of hierarchy and make equality, then everybody has abundance and everybody works together. We don't have the kind of division that we have right now, and separation and the unhappiness and the crime and everything like that. But really where it comes from is this creative empowerment of the individual, because when people are creatively empowered, meaning that they are willing to step into their own empowerment, they're willing to be who they came to be and to move themselves. Once that happens, there won't be any crime, there won't be any lack, there'll be full cooperation. And I saw this vision way back in 2002, and I'm like, oh my goodness, where did this come from? I've never thought anything about how it could change, but it can change. It can change that way. And it will happen very quickly, actually, relatively quickly. And what you see on the surface as far as people, killing other people and da-da-da, that's sort of like the last gasp. When people make that agreement within themselves, they can love themselves and that they don't have to be subject to someone else's ideas, that they can actually have their own ideas, their own original thoughts, and be equally valid in that reality system as anything else that has been taught or expressed. And they're standing sovereign inside themselves with self-love. And if you have that kind of self-love, not selfishness, but self-love, you can't hurt anyone else because you have equality. You don't have it. That self-love comes with that sort of protection built in. It's not like a... it doesn't adhere to the other reality system.
So when people are first finding their, quote, empowerment, what... I mean, it's like, do you see, like, surprises on their faces? Do you see people go like, whoa, I didn't realize I could do that? What ends up coming out when they first realize that they have their own empowerment?
It's the joy of rediscovering. It's the joy of remembering. That word, I love the word remember. It really comes from the story of Osiris and Isis, I think, was the mother of Osiris and or their wife or somebody, I don't remember, but what Osiris was cut up in several pieces and his body was spread out over the land and Isis collected the pieces together to reform his body. When we have been so separated from our inner self, from our inner child, we are like the cut up pieces of Osiris. We have to remember, we have to bring back our members, we have to bring back all the pieces of ourselves. And once we do that, it's like an aha, joyous moment. That's when you really get an inkling of infinity. You have an inkling of your part in it. And that idea of equality, that I had a wonderful mother who... was kind of a nature girl, and she knew a lot about biology and different animals in nature. She also had incredible respect, kind of like a shaman does, you know, like this idea of the world being alive and that everything is, you know, consciousness. And so she taught us enormous respect for animals. And we used to go out and capture animals and bring them back to the house. And watch them for a few days. You know, at any point in time, we would have turtles and snakes, and we weren't afraid of anything. And then we put them back out when, you know, if they ate, we'd keep them for a little while longer. And there was a turtle that used to eat silent, you know, on the fly. One time, my mother, she's seeing that the turtle's eaten, but I can't see him eating. And she woke up one night and he was looking away, but that is so weird. Mm-hmm. But their respect and our understanding and our awe, that feeling of being in the world with a sense of awe and wonder and respect is very close to that inner childlikeness that, you know, the being an artist can give you. I'm not saying all artists have it, but you know, to me, that's the ultimate goal. Yeah, I would say all wonder and like, oh my God, I really have this power. You know, I really have this ability inside of me. And sometimes a little bit of sadness, you know, to be finally empowered after years and years of being under the thumb of whatever, your own belief systems or your conditioning, your social conditioning. It can be a little sad to realize how long it's been, you know, before you discovered it.
Yeah, that's definitely true with a lot of people who've I've seen in my practice with when they're just like all of a sudden got like this consciousness and stuff like that that they've forgotten or haven't realized before. Well, we are actually at the end of our program here. Is there any last thing you would like to say, Aaliyah?
Well, went so quickly. I can't believe it. It was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Hey,
yeah,
you're welcome.
I would like to maybe make an announcement. I'm not sure when I'm going to do this. I'm probably going to do a few workshops. I might have an online thing that people can be part of, or maybe even a show myself. Right now, I'm redesigning my desk. I'd like people to sign up to join the email list. So you go to parallelminds.com. That's with TV. So PARALLELMINDZZ, as in zebra, zebra, .com. Parallelminds.com. And then there's a little thing at the top. It's like a little flag, and you subscribe, and you subscribe to the mailing list at that point, which means that you'll get occasional blog postings, and you'll be up to date with what's going on. I'm probably going to do a Kickstarter project with the Tarot Decks, which will be very exciting because it'll be limited edition. Tarot Decks I use as a tool in my practice, as a way to access people's subconscious, if you look at the psychological standpoint, but metaphysically, it's just amazing. So, that deck is made up of my painting. So it's very exciting to me. I'd love to, for people to be part of that if you can. I'm looking for a name for it, too. As a name at this point. What I can think of a really unique name that no one else has thought of, I'm all for it. Maybe I'll give them a try.
Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you so much, Aaliyah, for joining us today. And hopefully our listeners will have a better idea that that they can empower themselves and that they don't and that there is a new outlook on life than what they currently have. But we are going to close now, and I would like everyone to support the USO, and I'm very grateful for the men and women of the U.S. military who are supporting us and our freedoms. So thank you so much, Aaliyah.
Thank you. Go out and play.
All righty, I will. All right, bye.